And I bet if 7 and 8 equal 15, you're taking 8 and going second. Well, thank you. All right, and for sure, counsel for the appellant will have the full 15 minutes. All right, so counsel for the appellant, as you're aware, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument in chief. Whenever you're ready, just approach the pike, which you already are, adjust the microphone to your level, and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Eric Kirtle. May it please the court. I'm representing Matthew Francis, Traverse County County Attorney, in this appeal. We will be focusing on the Rule 24.02 clear abuse of discretion standard in attempting to persuade the court that denying permissive intervention was a clear abuse of discretion in this case. Important background principles on subject matter jurisdiction adjudication for this case are stated in Rule 12.08C, just to remind the court. Whenever it appears by suggestion of the parties or otherwise that the court lacks jurisdiction of the subject matter, the court shall dismiss the action. There are three key phrases there I'd like to remind the court. One is whenever, so that means whenever the district court has jurisdiction. By suggestion of the parties or otherwise, well, I don't represent a party, so I guess I'm otherwise. And then if there is no jurisdiction, the court shall dismiss the action. Now, I know the appeal's been bifurcated, but I think the court can take judicial notice that the authorities on subject matter jurisdiction, particularly court appeals cases mentioned in the brief, the recent Eggenberger case, which I was involved in, where a three-judge panel in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit interpreted the same. And
Mr. Kirtle, you seem real confident, of course, not only now, but in your briefing and reply that no private cause of action is a subject matter jurisdiction issue. But I didn't see, at least binding precedent, I don't know that I saw non-binding, that would tell us that. And when I think of the sort of defense that it is, and I recall 2 years ago when you argued it to our court, and I wrote the opinion that asking perhaps similar question, but I think one of the response briefs made a good point. It seems more akin to a Rule 12, a failure to state a claim, as opposed to a Rule 12, a jurisdictional issue. Because if convinced, a district court to so find, or our court to conclude that, that means that's you have no claim upon which to make, because constitutionally you cannot bring a private cause of action. Because otherwise, absent that, certainly constitutionality is exactly what the current subject matter jurisdiction district courts have. So if you follow my question, why are you so confident it is a subject matter? And because it would necessarily have to be so to have even your foot in the door, I assume, at this late date to intervene.
Well, the issue has been, you know, adjudicated repeatedly that if a statute doesn't have an explicit private cause of action, then there's no private cause of action. So
we're over. How does that equate to the subject matter? A district court, whether it has the ability to consider the subject, seems different than what.
Okay, so we read the statute, and if it says a person can sue the government for violating the statute. So that's how the Minnesota Tort Claims Act, Minnesota Environmental Rights Act, Minnesota Data Practices Act, there are all sorts of private causes of actions in statute. Those waive sovereign immunity and allow citizens to sue the government for violating that specific state law. And they're beautiful. They're beautiful. They allow the court to ensure the government's following the law. The statutes in this case don't have an express private cause of action. So, you know, I mean, there isn't an implied one in the Constitution.
That brings me back, though, that means there's no claim upon which to provide relief, and I understand that under Rule 12. I was just getting at the question that you really are confident about. You can tell by my questions I'm less confident about it, that it is actually a subject matter, and therefore can be brought sua sponte by the court at any time.
Well, right, but the subject matter of the Data Practices Act, the Tort Claims Act, the Environmental Rights Act, is you know, respectively, you know, data, towards environmental stuff. So that's the subject matter. And so the private cause of action makes that subject matter the court's business. And so if it's not the court's business, then there's no subject matter jurisdiction. So before the Minnesota Tort Claims Act, you know, ostensibly you couldn't sue the government for a tort, but then generously, the court says, the legislature says, we waive sovereign immunity. You can sue the state for torts, but you know, there are limits. You know, the remedies are specified. And so I think I don't want to get bogged down in that because I'm on the intervention, but these are wonderful questions, and they're very important ones. And if there wasn't case law supporting my position, I wouldn't be making it.
Sure not. Mr. Cardle, so, you know, this is not the first time that this has been brought to us, you know, on this, and here I like to sort of focus on the intervention of right, to assert this lack of private cause of action. I mean, we've kind of rejected that in Planned Parenthood, rejected that in this case, and then we've rejected it in Minnesota Secretary of State Simon versus MVO. So the concern I have is, you know, in this case, two other parties tried to bring this way back when Judge Sleater was, you know, writing the opinion, and it was rejected. So in this case, wasn't your client on notice that if he wanted to do this, the county attorney should have done this sooner when the other parties did and tried to intervene?
Well, it's for a moment, if the court would say, okay, it is a subject matter defense, because I think that's, you know, I have the case law supporting my point. Okay, so it's a subject matter defense, and Rule 12.08, as I mentioned, states that the district court has to address it. The district court didn't address it, and in the intervention denial admits it never addressed it, because it was never raised. So, okay, so on the permissive intervention, my client files after the appeal is not, it's announced the appeal won't be made by the attorney general. You know, where's the prejudice? I mean, we could not appeal the denial of permissive intervention. So the way that's perfected, according to McFarland Keppel, this is routine stuff, I'll quote, McFarland Keppel, Minnesota Civil Practice 14.434, persons desiring to intervene should seek both intervention of right and permissive intervention. The reason is that no appeal of the trial court's order denying permissive intervention lies, but orders denying intervention of right are appealable. The intervener can preserve appeal rights by coupling the application for permissive intervention with the one for intervention of right. This procedure can effectively obtain a right to appeal. Since permissive intervention is discretionary with the trial court, the trial court's decision will not be reversed unless a clear abuse of discretion is shown. So in the first appeals, Judge Slater, you're addressing intervention as a matter of right. So that isn't binding on the appeal here with respect to permissive intervention. There are lower standards in one way. Some factors don't apply, like inadequate representation, that doesn't apply. But one standard's higher, and that's clear abuse of discretion. So when you have Rule 12.08 repeatedly violated time, and time again, because remember it says raised by the parties or otherwise, you have a situation where my client has raised an appeal from the permissive intervention denial, and that has not been addressed by the earlier panel decision. So what you have then is, can they complain about prejudice? Well, they can't complain about prejudice before the motion to intervene was filed, because my client wasn't a party. I mean, my client wasn't a party, so how can they say that was prejudice? They can't claim prejudice from the appeal, because in this appeal, it would be no additional costs than if the Attorney General had filed the appeal. So there's no prejudice here. If the court, in fact, because subject matter jurisdiction can be raised in subsequent litigation, so I can file a petition for quo warranto against the Ramsey County District Court, by what authority did you issue a judgment in this case when you didn't have subject matter jurisdiction. We are actually trying to do this in the most efficient way possible. If a court consistently refuses to address a permissive intervention motion raising subject matter jurisdictional defects, then the way to properly raise that, if it's not appealed, is for the permissive intervention movant after judgment to file to the appeal to ensure that the question is properly raised in the Court of Appeals. I should mention, again, I grabbed McFarland v. Keppel just to show how routine my approach here is, quoting from the same page but different section, 14.433, quote, "It is beyond question that the purpose of Rule 24.02 is to further enhance the efficient use of our overburdened courts. Because this purpose is generally best served by resolving an entire controversy in a single action, permissive intervention should be freely granted. This is especially true in cases involving the public interest." So if I may.
Sure. And then when you're finished, I do have a couple of questions, Mr. Carl. Go right ahead.
Okay, if I just may finish. It's shocking to me in a case of such a public importance that the Attorney General wouldn't have welcomed the participation to raise the defense. And so to some extent, any prejudice to the Attorney General's office and the plaintiffs could have been avoided by them fairly presenting the issue, does this court have subject matter jurisdiction? And then so there was an opportunity there to mitigate. If the shoe were on the other foot, I know public interest groups, particularly on the left, have been allowed to freely intervene in cases. And in this case, it's not clear to me why groups on the right were not allowed to intervene, particularly when the subject matter jurisdiction was being questioned.
You know, this defense, one of the factors that we look at under intervention is the applicant's interest is not adequately being represented by the existing parties. You're suggesting the Attorney General should have made this argument and that it would have been a winner right away. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's up to the Attorney General to decide what affirmative defenses it wants to make. And just because it doesn't make one, there are lots of times like, well, I wonder why they didn't do that and why didn't the district court do this and that? Well, you know, I'm not them. So what's your best case to say that when the Attorney General doesn't make doesn't affirmatively assert affirmative defense, that per se means that your interest is not being adequately represented by the Attorney General?
Well, Rule 12.08 says that the court shall dismiss the case if there's not subject matter jurisdiction. And so this goes to the heart. It's not just another affirmative.
So if let's say it's a different case, but there was a statute of limitations defense, and they, for whatever reasons, decided not to assert it because, they thought there was an exception or they didn't want to make it. So you're saying an interested party could say, you should have made, we're going to intervene to assert the statute of limitations defense because we're not being adequately represented. So you could do that too? Or a party could do that too?
Well, I think Rule 12 has different rules on what's waivable and non-waivable. Rule 12.08 makes it very clear that subject matter jurisdiction is never waived, and even by a suggestion by a non-party, the court has an obligation to act. That's so different than the other defenses we've been talking about. But I'd like to, in response to that, I'd like to add, Judge, that I don't think it's fair for the panel, in light of the oral argument, to not take notice that my argument here orally is on permissive intervention, and inadequate representation doesn't matter. Okay. And so interest doesn't matter. The court below agreed we had a common question of law and fact. So the only real issue here is, were we timely? And under the circumstances, I believe I made a case that we were timely because there hasn't been any prejudice.
In all fairness, you are appealing both. Right.
Right, but only to perfect the permissive intervention. So I think there's no case on this, but here's what I guess the court was thinking, and what the
clarify that.
That when you appeal directly after the denial of the intervention as a matter of right, and then you probably have waived your chance to appeal at the end of the case. And so, but if you wait till the end of the case, then you can appeal as a matter of right, and you perfect your appeal with respect to permissive intervention. That's my reading of the case law. I try to be as fair as I can. And so my point is that we met the common fact and law test, and it's timely, so let's move on to the merits.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cardle. You will have rebuttal. I will now hear for counsel for the first respondent, please. Go right ahead.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Tanya Pellegrini, and I'm an attorney with the Loring Project. And together with Gender Justice, we represent the plaintiffs in the underlying lawsuit, Our Justice, Dr. Doe, and Mary Moe. Because failure to satisfy any one of the Rule 24.01 requirements will bar intervention as of right, this court must affirm the district court's order denying intervention unless it determines that the district court was wrong on all four elements. The district court, however, was correct in finding that the appellant failed to meet all four elements under Rule 24.01. First, the appellant's intervention motion is incredibly untimely, and it should be denied on that ground alone. He admits that he knew that the defendants were not raising his preferred defense since at least 2019, and that he waited until after the district court issued its final order before deciding to intervene. This wait-and-see approach taken by the appellant is disfavored by Minnesota courts for good reason. Allowing intervention after final judgment causes substantial prejudice to the existing parties by, among other things, denying or delaying finality of the lawsuit, by inserting a novel legal defense that was not litigated in the district court, and by forcing the existing parties to expend time and resources and litigating redundant motions to intervene.
Just to clarify, of course, not for lack of trying, right, to have it litigated. In other words, all the plaintiff and all the respondents objected to the intervention early on, which part of your response is that this is untimely. So there was certainly an effort, and to the extent that the Attorney General, you were probably happy, your clients, of course, that the Attorney General took the position that it did, but certainly it was not for a timely lack of trying to get it litigated.
Yes.
And it would have been a dispositive if they had won on the argument.
That is correct, Your Honor, but it is untimely to be intervening at this point by the appellant. The appellant fails to put forth any justification for his untimeliness, nor does he explain why he could not have sought to intervene years ago when other groups sought to intervene for the exact same reason. And he, as a county attorney, is a sophisticated litigant, and he's represented by the same counsel that brought those prior intervention motions.
Ms. Pellegrini, can I ask you on that? One of the arguments made as a county attorney is the question of enforceability of it. And you, both the respondents seem real confident in their briefs, but with no law to tell us that that's not a concern. Meaning, I'll just pose it differently. As a district court judge, I would often get briefs from a copy of an order from another district court to try to convince me that I should do something similar. And routinely, it had the sort of weight that our non-precedential decisions have. It may be persuasive or it may not be. So what law are you relying on to have such confidence that indeed this Ramsey County decision is enforceable in any other of the 87 counties?
So our position, Your Honor, is that that is a question that goes to the merits of the defense and not to intervention itself.
I understand that, although it's built into the interest argument of the county attorney, and so at least has a cognizability. Wouldn't you agree?
I would say that what he's asking for is a advisory opinion, and that does not create a legally cognizable interest in this case.
Well, how about if a county attorney in another county that has an abortion clinic and offers you services for which there's probably maybe or may have been some history, I assume you'd have a little bit of different response today than you do. The only question I just have is where that part in your brief that it is enforceable, including in Traverse County, derives from.
Yes, Your Honor. So I would say that the part in our brief is where it talks about there is a federal court case that we believe is persuasive authority that does look at Minnesota law, and it comes to that conclusion that a district court order a district court order in one county applies to all of them. And
so your point being is that would assuage Mr. Franzi's concerns because you find it persuasive and he might find it persuasive and that resolves it.
I would say that the other reason is that in this case, the parties, the defendants are the governor and the attorney general. That is the executive officer of the state and the executive prosecutor. And so these two individuals were enjoined from enforcing the laws by the district court. And if they can't enforce it, it would follow that none of the other county attorneys could enforce those laws as well, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The district court judge was present for every stage of this litigation, including those prior intervention attempts, and the district court is in the best possible position to determine the timeliness of intervention, and it got it right when it found that the appellant's request to intervene is simply too late. The appellant also does not have a legally cognizable interest in the subject of this lawsuit. Although his purported interest seems to shift and change and isn't always clear, it does seem that it is this interest in bringing his preferred defense of lack of subject matter jurisdiction. But simply wanting to join a case to champion your preferred legal defense is not a legally cognizable interest in the subject of the litigation. That is why this court and the district court have found that promoting that very same interest in promoting that defense is not sufficient to meet the requirements of intervention as of right, both in this court, in this case, and also in the case of Schroeder v. Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon. The district court correctly held that the appellant's zealous interest in promoting a specific defense is not a legally cognizable interest in the subject of this litigation as required by Rule 24.01. Third, because the appellant has no legally cognizable interest in the subject of this litigation, he cannot and doesn't even try to establish that his interest would be impaired or impeded by disposition of the lawsuit. Again, as the county attorney, if he does have confusion about the applicability of the district court's final order on him in Traverse County, that is an advisory opinion that he is seeking, and that is not sufficient under the rules of intervention to entitle him to intervene in this case, especially after final judgment has been rendered. Fourth, the appellant has failed to demonstrate that the representation by the defendants has been inadequate. Not only has both this court now and the district court on several occasions found that the representation by the defendants has been adequate, even though the defendants chose not to raise this lack of subject matter jurisdiction defense, but the appellant himself admits that the representation was adequate throughout the course of the litigation. The only objection he has is that the defendants did not appeal the final judgment, but that's merely a disagreement with a litigation strategy, and that is not sufficient to show that the representation was not adequate. Further, Rule 24.01 was...
Ms. Pellegrini, your time is up, so
okay.
If you want to kind of just... wrap it up.
Yes.
Actually, Judge Sleater has a question.
Ms. Pellegrini, yes, you had filed a conditional appeal, which our court has put in abeyance, and I just wanted to clarify with you that if we accept your position and affirm, are you asking us to dismiss that appeal?
Yes, Your Honor, we would dismiss it. We only filed it to preserve the right to appeal in the event that the appeal does move forward.
Okay, thank you.
So finally,
and Judge Larkin also has a question, Ms. Pellegrini.
And perhaps Mr. Cardell can address this as well. I'm intrigued by your argument that what is sought here is an advisory opinion. So it would be an advisory opinion regarding whether or not the judgment of a district court in Ramsey County is binding on district courts in other counties, other judicial districts?
Yes, if we accept his argument that that's his interest.
My district court has not held these laws unconstitutional. scenario then where that the issue would be put before the court, is this other district court decision binding in this other district court or not?
Yes, in that situation it would. Here it would not, because even if he is allowed to intervene, the question of lack of subject matter jurisdiction wouldn't resolve that issue about whether it applies to him or not. So that's why he doesn't have this legally cognizable interest in the subject by only wanting to intervene to raise this defense.
Well, there's some persuasive authority that says a district court decision from one district, one county, is binding on all other district courts, but we don't have any authority that says that. Making an advisory opinion.
That is correct,
and
Your Honor.
Perhaps allowing for the future a situation where a court has to decide that issue because someone is trying to enforce a law in Clay County that a Ramsey County District Court judge said is unconstitutional.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Pellegrini.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll now hear from counsel for the other respondent, please, the state of Minnesota.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jennifer Olson, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the state respondents, and here with me today is Solicitor General Liz Kramer. Mr. Franzese does not dispute that he has known about this litigation since it started. Not only that, it was obvious that state respondents were not going to assert the defense Mr. Franzese now seeks to advance way back in 2019 when they filed their motion to dismiss. And yet, when that became obvious, Mr. Franzese did not seek to intervene, but instead he waited until after the district court issued its judgment on the merits, more than 3 years later. Minnesota courts do not allow intervention where proposed interveners take this kind of wait-and-see approach. Then, when Mr. Franzese finally did seek to intervene, he relied on an interest that this court has already considered, including in this very litigation, and found insufficient under Rule 24.01. This appeal presents narrow procedural issues, and this court should reject Mr. Franzese's attempt to distract from those issues.
Ms. Olson, I'm going to follow up kind of this conversation we've been having about the enforceability and the advisory, mainly because even in my hypothetical, you would probably agree then even a county that provided abortion-related services and a county attorney there, it would still likely not be a concrete interest, is your point, because the issue of its effect enforceability in that county has not been decided, would be advisory, and therefore the county attorney just has to make a decision the county attorney makes whether to follow this decision or not. Would that be a fair summary of the Attorney General's position with regard to that as an example of a concrete interest?
If I understand your question correctly, I am not sure that that would be a concrete interest for purposes of this litigation. I think it's true that if a county attorney decided that the Deviscavi decision does not stand for the proposition that we believe it does, it's our position that that decision stands for the proposition that the Ramsey County order is binding statewide. But if a different county attorney took a different tact, I think, as you said, that county attorney would go ahead and take a different position, and then if there was litigation that resulted at that point, then that would play out that way.
And so hence, there'd be no need to intervene. You just decide it if it comes to you, if an issue comes. But it's not a basis to intervene in this action.
Right. It would be a different litigation with different facts and different parties.
Thank you.
Ms. Olson, I'd like to talk about one of the factors dealing with, you know, adequacy of representation. And I think you may have cited this in your brief, but, you know, in the Eighth Circuit, the Chicklow decision, the appellate court said, we conclude that the proposed interveners must show something more than mere failure to appeal. And then it goes on to say, even a decision not to take an appeal is ordinarily within the discretion of the representative. The district court excuse me, the appellate court then went on to say, admittedly, failure to appeal combined with diverging interests between the representative and the proposed intervener is surely enough to warrant intervention. There are certain other situations in which failure to appeal will be a key factor in showing the need for intervention. And one of those cases that it cited was, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Yanegues versus Arizona, 939 Fed Second 727. Governor failed to appeal from judgment invalidating initiative measure. Governor had previously expressed political opposition to the measure. Why doesn't that case apply here, since it would appear the Attorney General, you know, did express opposition to these statutes, and therefore he is diverting from the adequacy of representation of Mr. Cardell's clients? Why isn't it, what about that case?
Yes, Your Honor. So I want to start from the baseline that because of the unique constitutional role that the state respondents have here in managing litigation on behalf of the state of Minnesota and speaking in Minnesota courts with the public interest in mind, their defense here is presumed adequate as a matter of law.
I agree.
Addressing the case that you are mentioning, I would point to the Helgeland case, which was cited in our briefing. That was a Wisconsin Supreme Court case dealing with insurance and benefits. And in that case, the Attorney General had made public statements expressing support for the rights of same-sex couples. The Wisconsin Supreme Court in that case concluded that those statements were insufficient to demonstrate inadequacy because the Attorney General never addressed the statutes that were specifically at issue. Similarly, in this case, none of the state respondents has ever addressed the constitutionality of the statutes at issue in this litigation. So because of that distinction in the facts and the cases we're talking about, I think the Helgeland case is instructive.
Ms. Olson, what about, one of the arguments you make is that, or at least one of the factual arguments is, the county attorney, there are no abortion clinics in Travers County, so this is not going to be a problem in Travers County. I mean, what if it was, for whatever reason, the Attorney General, this is a hypothetical, decided, there's this new drunk driving law. I'm not going to, and it's been declared unconstitutional, I'm not going to appeal that. And the county attorney then comes in and says, I want to intervene. And you say, there are no bars and no one drinks alcohol in Travers County. So therefore no harm, no foul. I mean, at the end of the day, some of these statutory provisions have felony provisions, which presumably the county attorney could bring charges on. So why isn't this case, since there are felony provisions, why doesn't the county attorney, even though you are the sole representative, why doesn't he get to enforce laws or intervene in laws for which there are felony provisions for which he can prosecute or not prosecute?
In order to have an interest for purposes of Rule 24.01, you need to show that you have a concrete legal right that will be impacted by the litigation. Mr. Franzese here has not shown that. He's not established that he has ever prosecuted under the statutes at issue, and he has not shown that he had any intention to prosecute under the statutes at issue in the future. I think similar to the hypothetical that you raised where there's a county where there are no bars and no one drinks, that county attorney would not have the ability to intervene in an ongoing litigation in order to express a view on the hypothetical statutes that you mentioned. I do think if that county attorney wanted to start his own lawsuit regarding those statutes, that would be his option to have his opinion heard on that.
Comes back to the advisory opinion issue. I mean, one thing we always hear is, we want certainty in the law. People want to know what they may and may not do. And we have no law that says a decision from one district court judge is binding on all other district court judges in the state. So it seems that we're leaving open the scenario you described, a particular county attorney who is in a position to seek to prosecute someone under the laws that have been declared unconstitutional in Ramsey County could go forward and do that. And then is it just that, well, we'll wait for that case, and then in that case, we'll force the courts to make a decision regarding whether or not a district court judge's decision in one county binds all other district courts, and we'll just wait for that day to come?
The Davis-Gavi decision, the federal court case, is instructive here. In that case, Judge Davis relied on the fact that the attorney general is charged with prosecuting crimes, not the county attorneys. The county attorneys, when they prosecute crimes, are doing it on behalf of the state. So to the extent that the governor and the attorney general are enjoined from prosecuting crimes under the statutes in this case, the county attorneys would also be enjoined. And I think as a public policy matter, too, Judge Davis's decision in Davis-Gavi makes sense, because as this court pointed out in its opinion cited in Mr. Franzese's brief, the Chauvin case, there are concerns about if rights are different depending on what court you're in. And it should not be the case that someone's constitutional rights depend on which district court they happen to be in. So I think for all the reasons that Judge Davis identifies,
I have a problem with the notion that there's been no review and there will be no review of this district court judge's decision, yet you're saying it binds all other judges and it's beyond review of the appellate courts? That concerns me.
And I might just follow up, Ms. Olson, because that drew my attention too. It's the obvious, it may be the elephant in the room kind of a scenario why the Attorney General didn't appeal it, forgetting the defense and anything else, but it goes to this point because you just raised a very good policy argument that it should be binding when you have such an impactful decision affecting the citizens of the state, yet there's no law saying it is, and the Attorney General decided not to appeal it so that there would be a decision made. Now, I realize that is, again, part of the argument of a lack of a concrete because it's advisory, but it does leave a gaping legal hole in 86 counties.
The jurisdiction of the district courts in Minnesota extends throughout the state of Minnesota. That was one of the things that Judge Davis pointed to in the Davis-Gavi decision. So I think for that reason, for the reason that crimes are prosecuted on behalf of the state of Minnesota, that the decision is binding throughout the state of Minnesota.
That would be your argument if an issue came. It's not our issue today, of course, and it's advisory, as both everyone agrees.
But then what, that's not the issue we're asked to decide, but just to point out the problems. What if a district court judge says, I don't think the intoxilizer is accurate. I hold the intoxilizer is inaccurate. It may not be used. Does that mean the intoxilizer may not be used anywhere in the state of Minnesota because one district court judge ruled that way? That seems to be your argument.
I think the hypothetical that you're raising is different because in this case...
Because you would have appealed that one.
Yes. That's why it's different.
No.
And have. Forever.
The statutes in this case were enjoined. It wasn't just a situation where a district court issued an opinion about an intoxilizer and it's...
But if the judge in my hypothetical said, I find that the intoxilizer is an unconstitutional search, it's unreasonable, therefore I'm enjoining use of the statutes that require a driver to submit to a breathalyzer test if he's been arrested, probable cause, DWI. And no one appeals that. So it's your position that that enjoinment from that one district court judge is now binding on all of Minnesota judges?
I'm
just kind of playing out how it will work under your argument.
If I'm understanding your hypothetical correctly, I think that it is right. I will admit I have not ever practiced criminal law. I don't know if there are other types of methods for obtaining someone's blood alcohol level.
But I'm just talking like big picture. District court judge says intoxilizer test is unconstitutional. It's an unreasonable search. I'm holding 169A, whatever it is, which requires a driver to submit to an intoxilizer test if he's been arrested for probable cause, driving while impaired, he's been read the advisory. If he doesn't take the test, he gets charged with a crime. I'm enjoining enforcement of that statute because it's unconstitutional. So, I mean, your argument, taking to its logical limit, is that, you know, district court judge up in Brainerd, say that with love, used to live there, makes that decision, that means that no judge in the state of Minnesota can enforce the laws having to do with criminal test refusal on a DWI case, based on the decision of one judge in Brainerd.
I don't want to step outside my understanding of the law in this space. So with that being said, I think that a district court's order finding something like that unconstitutional would be binding throughout the state of Minnesota in the district courts in the absence of an appeal.
Understood.
And there may be different considerations.
And I think that is your position. I just want to make sure I understand your position.
Yes. I'm out of time. So I will close by saying that this appeal presents the narrow procedural issue of whether Mr. Franzese has satisfied all of the requirements of Rule 24.01. He does not. The district court's order should be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Olson.
Thank you.
Mr. Cardle, you will have the last word, sir.
Well, there were two ships passing the night. As the court recognized, my argument was based on 24.02, and in response, we just got 24.01 arguments. So below, the court agreed with us.
Can I just clarify, are you asking us not to consider that part of the district court's order with regard to
Oh, no, we're relying on the brief. It's just that we win on 24.02. And so on 24.02, Judge Sleater, your opinion, the opinion in the Secretary of State case, they don't apply because that was intervention as a matter of right. So now we're talking about permissive intervention, and you know, and basically, you know, the case laws that I quoted from McFarland-Keppel is beyond question. The purpose of Rule 24.02 is to further enhance the efficient use of our overburdened courts. Because this purpose is generally best served by resolving an entire controversy in a single action, permissive intervention should be freely granted. This is especially true in cases involving the public interest. So in this particular case, we have the Rule 12.08 basically saying that whenever it appears by suggestion of the parties or otherwise, the court lacks jurisdiction of the subject matter, the court shall dismiss the action. Now, this appeal has been bifurcated, so we can't get to the merits, but that means the court, you know, should say, well, look, Mr. Cardle and the appellant have some arguments that the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. They were raised many times before the court, and 12.08C was not followed by the court early on when it was suggested. That's an abuse of discretion. That's an abuse of discretion. That's an abuse of discretion. So now we're here saying, okay, now the Attorney General is not going to raise the subject matter jurisdiction defense as part of appeal because the Attorney General hasn't appealed. So then permissive intervention should be freely granted. There's no requirement to show an interest. There's no requirement to show inadequate representation. All we have to show is that the party is not prejudiced.
And that it was timely.
Timely, right, which relates to prejudice. So with respect to that point, we filed as soon as we found out, I think it was about a week or so, the motion to intervene after the Attorney General announced the Attorney General would not appeal. The respondents here claim prejudice due to the district court proceedings. We were not parties to the district court proceedings. Those costs were incurred by them without us doing anything. In fact, we didn't file until after the judgment was entered. With respect to the issue presented in the motion to intervene, there are opportunities for these parties to mitigate. As the court mentioned, there are several efforts to intervene. There are motions to dismiss. Why the parties did not encourage the court to follow Rule 12.08C at the beginning of the litigation after these suggestions or otherwise were made is hard for me to understand. There can be no prejudice based on the appellate costs. It's the same cost as if the Attorney General appealed. Further, as the court knows, this if the premeditation invention is allowed, if the court were to agree with us that there's no subject matter jurisdiction, then there would be no remand. So where's the prejudice to these parties? They initiate a case that they should have known the court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction for. The district court judge did not follow Rule 12.08C, even though my clients were suggesting otherwise, that the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction. The Ramsey County District Court is not the Minnesota Supreme Court. The Ramsey County District Court does not create private cause of action. I think, Judge Slater, you and I had a nice conversation about one with whether this private cause of action exists or if it's a defense or a subject matter a jurisdiction defense. But the point is that's for this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court to decide, not the Ramsey County District Court. The Attorney General's office has been conflicted on this. As I've noted in earlier briefings, sometimes the Attorney General says this is a defense that throws out the case. Other times, like in this case, it says, no, we're not going to apply that defense. But it's a matter for this judicial branch to address, as 12.08C says, is the policing of subject matter jurisdiction is a fundamental function of the judicial department. And what you do is very, very important because it communicates to the state legislature what's acceptable for a waiver of sovereign immunity and a private cause of action. Where this court does a good job in policing subject matter jurisdiction, the legislature will be do a good job in writing clear, concise laws waiving sovereign immunity and authorizing private lawsuits. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cardle. Thank you, Ms. Olson. Thank you, Ms. Pellegrini. The matter was well argued and well briefed. We will issue our decision within 90 days. Since that was the last oral argument of the day, we are adjourned.